doing quite well, has been well received, and in fact was recently named one of five finalists for the 1989 National Book Award, which will be announced later on this month. He is in Champaign-Urbana to give a reading from the Mambo Kings. This is a MillerCom event, by the way. It is open to the public. That's tonight at 8 o'clock in the New Music Building Auditorium. And I would encourage you to take in the event if you can, because I think it's a rare opportunity to be able to hear a writer reading from his or her own work. So one doesn't get that opportunity very often. Oscar Iuelos was born of Cuban parents in New York. He's a graduate of City College. His first novel, Our House in the Last World, was published in 1985. He has received a number of honors, including the 85 Rome Fellowship in Literature of the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters and Fellowships from the Ingram Merrill Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the New York State Foundation for the Arts. And he makes his home in New York. And we're pleased to welcome him here to the show. I'm glad you could
spend
some time.
It's great being here.
The book, you know, I hesitate to try to, I hope as we talk people will get an idea of what the book is about, and I really hesitate to to try to give some capsule, you know, because I think that wouldn't do it justice, because it's about a lot of things. One thing that it is about is Latin music, and it is the story of two brothers who are born in Cuba and come to the United States and are involved in the Latin music scene in New York in the 50s, I guess, and about their lives, their success that they enjoy in their music, and it is too about, I think, the emotions that this kind of music likes to deal with. What you know, for you, what are those? I mean, what is the special attraction of this kind of music?
Well, first of all, I grew up hearing that music, and secondly, I wanted to write a novel that would sort of reflect that 4 in the morning, drowsy, in love, been out all night dancing, having a few drinks feeling that one gets when you're with a woman, or if you're a woman, when you're with a man. I wanted to do a book that would let people inside that sort of mysterious, steamy, strange, mirror-columned world of boleros. You know, I'd hear these slow songs, even corny songs like Bésame Mucho, which have been really standards for a long time. This is the music of my parents' generation. It's the music of so many people. I mean, it's sort of a music that is, in fact, become so American because everyone has memories that they can associate with it. And so I sort of wanted to write a book that sort of just tapped into one possible aspect of how a person would feel hearing it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah,
folks, if it doesn't make sense, call in and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Do you think that this kind of music is particularly good at transmitting certain kinds of feelings, or does that overly or romanticize it, and we say, well, you know, a lot of kind of music can transmit those kinds of feelings.
Well, you know, it's an idea of songs of love, and I mean, I was jogging in the bitter cold this morning. It's like Miami Beach here. I really love it. and I was listening to a corny Paul McCartney song, and it was just lovely. I mean, it was just tried to evoke a simple, pleasant affection and emotion. And these songs, even though they're written in the Latin idiom and the lyrics are totally crazy, I was hearing one song the other night and I was with a friend of mine, and the lyrics, it sort of captured the way one could feel when one is in love, but it said, the lyric went along the line of, I know that I must love you because when you hate me so, I know I am in love because I am in pain, you know? And it's sort of these boleros, and if you listen to a lot of boleros, they sort of explore this sort of mixed up, crazy confusion about being in love and courtship and how you really put something on the line when you fall in love. And it's about courtship. And I mean, I know people who've gone out dancing for 35 years, you know, in Manhattan. My godmother is 86 years old and she goes dancing, Carmen. And it's an eternal entity. Music is something like a sweet thought that you have about a person. And I think it's the truth. People love music, and in my way, I wanted to sort of publicize that music through my book, and just say to people, look, here it is. The people were going to nightclubs and dance halls in the 50s, and there was a certain kind of music going on that may have been especially particular to New York, but is universal. I've gotten calls from people all over the country. I got a call from a guy in Kansas City who said that he wanted to know if I could find a musician named Joe Local, who used to have a mambo band in Philadelphia, and he used to work for a company there. But he met his wife then, and they used to go dancing all the time, and that was his music, even though he was from a totally different part of the country. I think it's universal in its appeal, or at least I think so, but who knows?
Did you have to do research to get to? It seems that you got to know this music scene really intimately. You mentioned the names of a lot of places where people play, the names of a lot of performers, and you also talk in some ways about the music itself and how it developed. How did you develop your background in this kind of music?
Well, as I said before, I grew up hearing it on the streets in Manhattan. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and basically that's what you heard coming out of car radios, that's what you heard coming out of the windows. I was really struck by something when I was about 12 years old. I went to a grammar school 8th grade dance at this Church of the Ascension, and there was a mambo band playing full steam, but they were playing rock and roll standards, and you knew they were moonlighting, and you knew, but one guy was a really great-looking guy. He was wearing a lavender suit, and he had sort of a frilly collared shirt on and frilly sleeved, and he was just shaking the maracas, you know, and he was sort of off in the wonderland, like Little Nemo, and that's where you would hear it, and they were playing these rock and roll things, but then they went into a few mambos, and it was just great. It was typical, or you go to block parties, or you'd walk down LaSalle Street in Manhattan, which is near 125th Street, the heartland of syncopated rhythm, and you'd hear bands rehearsing in their living rooms. You'd hear rock and roll bands, you'd hear jazz players, you'd hear, mambo bands. I mean, I heard it everywhere, and I never really... An image in my first novel has to do with just going to the beach and hearing, like, what I called in that novel tinny Latin music. Before the days when they had these huge boom boxes, people used to walk around with these screechy-sounding little Japanese radios, and you'd hear it everywhere and all the time. But one day it really hit me. There was music in my first book, and it really made me interested in exploring that aspect of the culture, of Cuban-American culture. And I had an uncle who once played with Xavier Cugat. But I haven't seen him in 25 years. He's been dead for 20 years. When I was a kid, I'd be down in Miami, and he'd have all these pictures hanging on his garage wall. And in one of those pictures, he's sitting at a very handsome Cuban man, and I believe that was Desi Arnaz. And Desi used to sing with Xavier Cugat at a time when my uncle, who played the string bass, traveled with him, and he had a great life, he told me. He used to travel around Europe, he used to play Paris a lot, he used to travel all over Latin America. He worked in Havana, of course, in Miami and New York. So, you know, when I was looking, you know, when you start a novel, first of all, you sort of have to, there have to be things you want to say from within, but you also have to sort of know that world and find a world. And I've always played music myself. I play guitar, I play piano. I love musicians. I feel like I know them. Putting all these things together, sort of my uncle's life, just hearing this music on the street, also just loving it, and my own interest in music made writing about the scene really important to me. I mean, I suppose I could have written a novel about jazz players, straight jazz players, but I think this is a more specific and, I think, under-publicized world. And what happens is that you take a chance, you read interviews, you listen to radio shows, you go looking through old newspapers, you talk to musicians. I talk to a lot of musicians, and you can walk away with a certain amount of fact. But what really makes a difference in putting together a book is an imaginative leap. So when I wrote this book, I was truly worried about whether this would be an authentic kind of world that I present, because I don't want to rip off anyone, and I don't want to not convey a scene with clarity. And what happened is I get calls from band leaders and people like that saying, "You got it right, Jack."
Yeah, people saying that they felt like they were reading their life.
And the response has been really amazing. Reuben Blades just finished reading my book, and he said he loved it. And I hear from people like Larry Harlow, who was a big band leader in New York, interesting guy. His father was a Jewish band leader, Buddy Harlow, during the 1930s. And Larry ended up hanging out with Latin musicians, and he is a mambo king. Yeah. You go to his house, and it's all purple, lavender walls. I mean, it's really, truly incredible.
Our guest this morning is novelist Oscar Hiuelos. We're talking about his book, The Mambo King's Play, Songs of Love. You mentioned Desi Arnaz, and I want to have you talk about him because he appears as a character in this book. The two, as I said before, it's a story of two brothers who come from Cuba to the United States and form a band mm-hmm. called the Mambo Kings. They're playing a club in New York, and mm-hmm. Desi Arnaz comes in and he seems to with one song, which they have written, which is entitled "Beautiful
Maria of My Soul,"
mm-hmm. which also has a story behind it, because mm-hmm. that one of the brothers has had a love affair with a woman in Cuba, and spends the rest of his life really longing for this woman. He writes the song about her and about his feelings. In fact, he writes 22 versions of the song. And it is apparently a very popular number of the Mambo Kings. People uh-huh. really like the song. Uh-huh. So Desi Arnaz comes in, he hears them playing, and particularly likes this song, and invites them to make an appearance on the television show, I Love Lucy, which mm-hmm. they do. He flies them out to the coast, and they make an appearance on the program, which really, really helped make their name, and for a time they did very well. Why Desi Arnaz? How does he play into this story?
Well, it's interesting. Growing up, when I used to watch the I Love Lucy show, I always thought that Desi Arnaz was the star, not Lucille Ball. But it was nice. It was nice growing up around that image of a successful Cuban. I mean, if you just break the show down, if you see the way Latins are sort of portrayed in national media, either they're, they're usually play the heavies or they're losers or they're, certainly in the press for many years, Latins got bad reputation. Mostly you'd hear about them in connection with crime or something. And I think that it was wonderful to see Desi Arnaz, who's basically a very successful middle class a band leader with a whacked-out wife, and with a sense of humor, with his own temperament. But I also thought he was very Cuban when I'd watched the show. And the things I identified him as being specifically Cuban were, I think, a sense of melancholy that used to come through. Maybe I'm projecting my own feelings into him, but he seemed not that different from the Cubans who used to come over to visit with my father. My father loved this show. I mean, he grew up in Oriente, which is in the sticks in eastern Cuba, and he just loved that show. He loved that show and the Honeymooners, as a matter of fact. And I don't know, it was just it was a wonderful image for me.
That seems odd to me in a way, because I would think that some people might react negatively to that character of Ricky Ricardo, because he had that accent, and every once in a while he would launch into these long bursts of Spanish, and
which were hilarious, actually.
Well, to a Spanish speaking person, would they be
hilarious? Pretty funny. They're mostly I do a little of that in the book, and I sort of translate it, and basically what he used to say: "I can't believe that I married this crazy whacked out American. I should have listened to my mother and stayed with that nice Cuban girl I knew back in my town in Cuba. Oh my God, I wish I was back there. Oh my, you know, it's really hilarious." But he was what I felt from him was affection. I mean, just relating, and people say he was a caricature of a Cuban, and one could argue that any television. I mean, Ralph Crandon was a caricature of what bus drivers are about. But I think Desi Arnaz, I think, they had some stupid episodes and they had some stupid stories, and Lucy would say, You know, he'd say something and she'd say, I think so too, you know. But these are just gags. Desi Arnaz was in on the writing of the scripts. I mean, the guy was absolutely in control. Okay, so he may have made fun of himself for a laugh, but I can't imagine anyone watching that show thinking that it really puts down Latins or Cubans. In fact, the basic image is of a successful man. He's got, you know, runs a nightclub as a job. You know, they go on trips. They're not on welfare. They don't rob. They don't hurt. I mean, the basic, I've heard that from Latins, which, you know, these are cartoons, but they're cartoons that basically, if it is a cartoon, it's a cartoon that paints a nice picture. And, you know, musically, he wasn't the hippest singer in the world, but he did, you know, he'd be on a show and he would play real Cuban songs. And I think he was a popularizer, I guess a crossover. I mean, can you imagine America today without having had I Love Lucy show? I mean, it's hard. I mean, it doesn't change the world, but I think it makes a lot of people kindly disposed to maybe different kinds of culture. I mean, that when they started that show, I think they were going to originally do it with Fred McMurray. And,
really?
Yeah. That's I think CBS wanted. They were interested in the idea of the show. Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz took it on the road as sort of like a stage review for a while. And they put together a pilot, and they wanted Fred McMurray or someone like that to play the part of Ricky Ricardo. And Desi Arnaz said, forget it. You know, then it'll be just like another dumb 1950s sitcom. And I think the cross-cultural thing really gave it a lot of its strength.
Mm. Let's talk about the two characters, the two brothers in the book. Two guys who were really very different and yet maybe not so different. One of them was sort of the good time guy who was always, you know, out to have a good time, who was always the guy when he'd come into the bar or the nightclub, he was always buying everybody drinks.
Mm-hmm. Cesar, yeah.
Yeah, Cesar. Liked flashy clothes and, you know, really wanted to have a DeSoto, which mm-hmm. he eventually got. And his brother was much more introspective, more moody somehow. I mean, this was the man who had the love affair with
Maria.
And wrote the 22 versions of the song, and really never, even though he married, had children, had a wife who loved him, and I think he loved her, was still very much, you know, thinking about this other woman.
So a shrink sent me a note and said, it's mama, huh? That's what he said. Mother fixation or something is what he said. But
in your thinking about them and their characters, what brought him to the United States? What were they looking for here?
Well, see, one thing is there's this image that a lot of Latins come to the United States simply out of need, you know, that they're poor and they want to do better. But I think these were two brothers who were doing all right where they were, and they could have stayed in Havana. But they came because I think the older brother was ambitious and wanted to make it in the big time and just move ahead. And I think, you know, in the case of Cuban musicians, it's a different situation because, of course, the revolution came along and made going back a much more different and difficult proposition than it had been before. But I wanted to do a book about that pre-Castro generation of Cubans who could, they could do really complicated things like buy airplane tickets and get on them and come to New York and hang out and get jobs. And I mean, I don't think it was as a big move for musicians to come to the States. They were basically trying to make a better living. But of course, one of the themes in the book is it's funny how you can turn around and 25 years have gone by. And in the case of Cesar, who spent his lusty youth longing for women and wanting to make it big, he turned around one day and 30 years had gone by, and he was no longer a thriving, successful musician. He was no longer living in Cuba, but in New York. But he had built a new life for himself. And so his mind sort of thrives through memory and old songs. The book is framed by Cesar listening to old Mambo King records in a hotel room. And, you know, it's the old Rosebud structure. But basically it's about longing for the past. If you asked me before, Dave, about what these songs mean, everyone has association with a song. Song is memory. I mean, you fall in love with someone, you break up with someone, you see your lovely nephew or or your baby is born, like my friend Philip's baby, Nathaniel. Hello. All kinds of things happen, and you can always associate a song with it. And I think that in the case of Cesar, that whole life he led, coming up from Havana to New York in 1949 and starting a band, and all those episodes in their lives, I guess you would call it a classic success story that has its downturn eventually. But it's about memory, and he loved his brother, and he loved women, and he loved to have fun, he loved to make friends, and so he's remembering all this through the music. Mm. And, you know, it's about love, really. It's about songs of love.
But it's also, it's about desire for love that is...
It's not, well, in Cesar's case, he loved women physically, but he never got to know them. And I think it's about screwing himself in the end.
Yeah.
You know. And it's about love. And by the end of the book, he realizes how much he wanted to love and be loved. And in fact, I think he felt a lot of love in his life and was lovable and loving.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a compensation in itself.
You wouldn't want to convey the idea that the book is all about sadness or about that. I mean it's a lot about life, but it seems also about people who never quite got what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Nestor, the one brother, mm-hmm. he loved Maria, but he lost her. Cesar never maybe really connected deeply with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He had a daughter in Cuba that he wanted to have a relationship with, mm-hmm. but didn't. Mm-hmm. They were both had a very hard father who beat him, mm-hmm. and maybe one of the things that they were thinking about was did this man really love me, or mm-hmm. what kind of love was this? That a lot of it is about, about that basic need to love and be loved, and mm-hmm. how sometimes it doesn't go the way that you want.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of I intended to do an entertaining novel with the heart in it. I mean, a heart with a lot of feelings in it. I kind of think of it as a sheep in. A wolf in sheep's. I don't know how the the saying goes, but I consider it a serious novel about certain kinds of frustrations and emotions, and about how difficult it is to come by real love. Or there's a sweetness. I mean, one thing that runs through the book is a sweetness about childhood. I mean, here is this musician Cesar who's a lady killer. I mean, he can walk into a room and. I mean, he walks into a room in a bad mood, that everybody in the room is in a bad mood. He walks into a room in a good mood and everybody's happy. And he basically can have anything that he wants, but it just doesn't capture for him the kind of lovely emotions he felt as a child when, simple moments of, say, being with his mother and having, before the world became complicated, before life became more difficult. I guess it's that whole Garden of Eden idea that before awareness, before he figured out that people get hurt or that people get lost. And it's really, I think in a way it's a novel about childhood, but I don't know.
Hmm.
I mean, the more I think about these, you could say anything about anything, but it's really about lost emotions,
Yeah. We'll talk some more with Oscar Iuelos in a moment. We're talking about his book, The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. This morning on Focus 580, we're talking with novelist Oscar Iuelos. His book is The Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love. It is his second novel. It's been nominated for a National Book Award. He's here to read from his work. He'll be giving a reading tonight at 8 in the New Music Building Auditorium. This is a Millercom event, and it is open to the public. Everyone who would like to attend is welcome. Also, he will be doing a book signing at Follett's today from noon to 1. So if you would like to meet him, say hello, have him sign a copy of the book. He would be happy to do that. Also, we would be happy to take calls, too. I had somebody else who was on hold, and I'm sorry I kept him waiting too long. If you'd like to call in, 333-WILO, 800-222-WILO. How much of this experience, one always has this temptation to think that, all writing is autobiographical, and mm-hmm. maybe sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. How much of this reflects your own experience, and in particular the experience of your parents? Because they, well, like the brothers, they at least came from Cuba to the United States. And undoubtedly were looking for something. Did they find it?
Well, they were part of the generation. When my father came up, he had a good time. I mean, he went to nightclubs. He was part of that whole scene. So in a way, I'm commemorating that aspect of his life through the book. They came up. They had, you know, they built a life for themselves. And my father had a very, very strong work ethic. I mean, he was a hotel worker. He never made a lot of money, but he always went to work. And he, you know, I think he was successful. I mean, he raised two sons who, you know, we didn't become career criminals or drug addicts. And I'm a writer. My brother's a painter. And, you know, real rich professions, folks.
Yeah, artists. That's not exactly, you know.
Yeah, we're really sensitive. So, you know, we can we have that wonderful conversation of have a deeply, thickly padded souls, but that's about it. But, you know, we turned out okay. I mean, it was productive. My father passed away over 20 years ago. So, you know, the old working himself to death thing. But they had good value systems, and they had a good work ethic, and that's what they brought with them from Cuba. Again, I have to say my own family breaks the stereotypes that, you know, a lot of people have about Latins. But I know many, many Latins who didn't have breaks and who did very well. I know a woman who raised four Puerto Rican sons, and they both all four of them became lawyers. And this was in Manhattan, you know, no breaks, nothing. They just went ahead and strived, and that's what they got. I think that's what the book is about, also striving for something and more or less getting it. Even though Cesar is not a star at the end of the book, you kind of felt that he had a hell of a life and that, you know, he lived it as fully as he could. That's all anyone can do. And being alive and living a certain way, you may be wrong, but living that life with conviction is being better than being complacent. And I have to say that about my parents' generation. They and a lot of Cubans simply came up to the States because they wanted to see and experience something different. But there's something else totally attached to that. I think I always think about movies when I think about my parents' generation. And I think that they were affected, living in small towns, by all the Hollywood movies that came through. And there was a curiosity about it. My father came here when he was about 36 years old, a long, long time ago. And, you know, one could reason that it was a normal immigration for whatever reasons, ambition, or maybe he had his reasons. But he'd also visited New York City as a 14-year-old boy. And he stayed up here for 3 weeks and did nothing but went to nightclubs and with a cousin or something and went to Broadway shows, and he fell in love with the city. And I always thought of him as sort of, you know, being sort of shy. But when I learned that he came up here at 14, I said, one day I want to write a novel about a small town hick from the middle of nowhere in Cuba coming to New York at 14 years old to visit. I mean, it must have been incredible. And that's probably what was going on in his head many years later as he thought about when he decided to come to the States. So I think, you know, I just wanted to point out a generation of people who just, you know, are normal like, you know, everyone. I mean, I don't know if that's grammatical or makes sense, but
it's
excuse me.
I'm, you know, happy to say that you know, that hear you say it, that you feel that Cesar really was a success. I guess some, you know, some people would say that, you know, maybe some of what the book is about is the idea of the glass ceiling, you know, mm-hmm. that for a lot of people, minorities especially, there's only so far you can go in this country, and then you can watch, mm-hmm. you can see what's up the rest of the ladder, but you can't go yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, that's why Desi Arnaz
interesting. He's the guy who
made it.
Who made it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why he's... Mm-hmm. See, he wasn't... you know, he was a clever man, obviously, intelligent, but he really epitomizes how far someone can go. I mean, he wasn't the greatest musician in the world. He wasn't the greatest singer. He was a drop-dead handsome man when he was younger. But, I mean, there are lots of drop-dead handsome men running around in the world who never go anywhere. And I think Desi Arnaz is an example of how far one can go. And again, I think, see, when I started writing the novel, I wanted to do something about these kinds of personalities, the brothers, one melancholic, and the flip side being, you know, outrageously interested in life. Parentheses, women. And I wanted them to intersect somehow with someone like Desi Arnaz. And it took me a few years to figure out, bring these ideas together. How can one write a story about Latin music and also bring Desi Arnaz into it and not in a real way? And so I figured out this thing with the show, you know, that he could hear them and invite them onto his show. Mm-hmm. And also was I had a lot of fun doing that in a way. I mean,
did Desi Arnaz, he actually did do that? He apparently, you know, knew other musicians that, and I don't know if they were friends or, you know, he was hoping that might, you know, boost their career along.
I think he hired, when I'd seen that, you know, whenever I watched the I Love Lucy show, he always has these Cubans doing little things here and there. And I've talked to people who had known him, and they say that he'd hire his friends, yeah. You know, just give him jobs. He was a real nightclub person, really. Someone was telling me a story about Desi Arnaz sort of hanging out at parties with Fred Allen, the comedian, and just taking over the piano and singing and playing around all night and flirting with the ladies while Lucille Ball would sit around sort of miffed and waiting to go. Yeah. And he was quite an entertaining and, you know, happy guy, I think. Although he had his problems too, like Cesar. Anyway, that's public record anyway. But I'm sorry, what were you? I sort of lost it.
No, that's. I mean, I just was thinking that you know the situation that you construct for the book is very plausible and probable. You know that such a thing would have happened because he apparently. There are hints that he actually did, you know, did stuff like that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the thing where he asked them to come on.
Oh,
the,
yeah.
To the program
and
play.
Many people assume that it's the novel. You asked me about autobiography. They assume that I've had reviews written about the book where they say, well, Oscar took this story of his uncle and his father and transformed it into a novel. And I've had people say, yes, I've seen that episode, even though I made up the episode. They say, yes, I remember it clearly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're making a movie out of Mambo Kings next year. Universal Pictures is doing it. And, there's a publicity thing going on. One of the things they're going to do for the film is, I think, hold open auditions for Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball lookalikes, which would be a lot of fun. And right now we're looking for the kind of actors who could play the parts of Nestor and Cesar. And, you know, there are different people. Kevin Kline is possibly doing Cesar, but who knows? Yeah.
That's very interesting.
You have someone on
Yes, we do. Here. Let's talk with them. Let me give you the telephone number again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to call in. Here's somebody right here on line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I listen to books on tape, and I wondered if you know if the book's out on tape, and if authors have any say on who reads it.
You mean who would be doing a narration? I think that's something that an agent works on or their approach. I know that Amy Tom, who wrote the Joy Luck Club, has a book on tape, and I think she reads from it herself. But sometimes I think they just get actors to come in and read these books. I think you have to be fairly formal and also be good at it.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think they seek you out. I don't know if it's something that your agent can go and say, let's make a tape out of this thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I answered your question.
But. No, you answered it. And I was wondering, I hope this isn't a silly question, but do you enjoy reading your book out loud?
Depends.
Yeah? Does it make you nervous, or...?
No, it's nice to have contact with people and to see how an audience responds to your work. I take it fairly seriously, and I'm delighted when people like it, but sometimes, you know, someone will pass out in the third row but usually it's a very positive experience. It's good to, the thing I like about doing readings and stuff is having contact with people, basically. I've gone to readings where writers have gone on and on for an hour with some of the most dreadful, thick, morose, obtuse stuff in the world, And, you know, really never once looking up from the text and just relating. So I like readings in the old-fashioned style where, you know, the author talks about the book and maybe he discusses what he's doing with it and then, you know, read sections of text. Because I think the contact is important because otherwise people will always have the book. And I think it's a much more intimate experience when someone reads it theirself. On the other hand, I think people just want to maybe see what the author's like and you know, the limousines, the beautiful women, the champagne, the jewelry, all that
stuff.
Is
the new music hall tonight?
What's that?
All
anyway,
right, well,
thank you.
I'll be there tonight listening.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other calls are welcome. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned the film, the fact that they're going to make a film. Mm-hmm. Are you involved at all with screenplay? Or how much control do you have over what they do with this?
Well, the producer of see, Hollywood's a funny joint, folks. What they do is they're not interested until someone's interested in it. And see, Arnie Glimcher, who made Gorillas in the Mist, read the book early on and was really you know, and he sort of bought it, and at the time, his agent in Hollywood said, no one will ever want to see a, you know, movie, or how could you make this a movie, and why are you, what are you, crazy, blah, blah, blah. But Arnie has a lot of dignity and is a very classy man, and he said, I know there's a great film in this book. And of course, the book came out and got great reviews, and it got front page Los Angeles Times rave, and of course, about 50 studios are calling my agent at that point, and Arnie's going, ha-ha, I already have it. So, but he's a first-class man, and what he did is we got Cynthia Sidre, who's a Cuban who came up here in 61. She's a screenwriter. She's one of the co-scripters of In Country, the recent Bruce Willis bomb. And but she's also doing a movie, Little Havana, right now, and she's an incredible pro. She's done a lot of Miami Vice episodes. I don't know if that's a recommendation, but she's a lovely, lovely woman, and she's read my book a zillion times like Arnie has, and if you see their copies, it's hilarious. It's all marked up. It's sort of edited down into a movie, and she'll be working on it, and I'll be on as a consultant, which means see, what usually happens in Hollywood is that they have a script, and they're spending so much money on getting the script, and what happens is that they bring in someone else to make sure that it's a good script, and he ends up undoing the script, and then they get a director who looks at the script and changes that, and then they'll get someone to look in at his changes, and they change it, which is why you sometimes get horrible, misguided scripts. But Arnie Glimcher is just interested in keeping it to one script writer and having me look it over and make sure that it's more or less up to snuff. So I'm not going to be writing it. Although when I conceived the movie, I saw it opening with a sort of love scene. So Cynthia sends me her screenplay for Little Havana, and it opens up with just about the same screen love scene that I had imagined for Mambo King. So I think that I have the right person there.
Hmm. Have you been to Cuba?
I was there when I was a little kid, 4 years old.
So as an adult, you haven't?
No. I'm thinking I might go down there in early next year to do an article for a magazine. I want to take my brother with me. I might go down to spend 2 or 3 weeks there in the new year, but I'm still talking to these people. I'd like to go back.
What would you be interested in doing or seeing, or you just go to try to soak up whatever you?
I think I would go to the towns where my mother and father grew up and try to find out what the real story was behind the families. I think do corny things like go look at my grandfather's grave. I mean, this sounds maudlin, but Cubans are a little on the maudlin side sometimes. You know, just do things like that. Try to find out as much as I can about my antecedents in Cuba. I don't know if it's possible because of the revolution and also because my mother is 78 years old, or 75 for 3 years anyway, and she was the youngest of three. And so, you know, that's getting on the older side. And so I don't know who's left there. But I would like to find more family down there. I know my father has some surviving sisters still living out in Oriente. where, by the way, Desi Arnaz came from. But
yeah. So again, there was this the connection between the brothers and and Desi.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, my father was about that. I mean, you know, they were more or less the same age, and I'm sure they may have met somehow, even if only at dance halls or something.
Yeah. I didn't ask you this before we started, but I was wondering if you might read a little bit from the book.
Oh.
Because I would like people to get a little feeling of it. But, I mean, if
okay.
that...
Okay, no problem.
I don't know if that...
I'll read a page. How's that?
Okay.
The author would like to thank... No. Well, I'll tell you, I'll read you, like, just a little thing I have. I wanted to treat the book sort of like a record, so I have a little blurb in the very beginning of the Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love, side one, and it just says this. This was sort of my intention with the book. With a flick of your wrist on your phonograph switch, the fiction of the rolling sea in a dance date on a Havana patio or in a smart supper club will become reality. Certainly, if you cannot spare the time to go to Havana or want to revive the memories of a previous trip, this music will make it all possible. From the Mambo Kings Play Songs of Love, Orchestra Records, 1210 Lenox Avenue. This is told from a nephew's point of view, and it's sort of, I kind of think of it as sort of like jacket copy in a way. For the book, record jacket copy. Anyway, it was a Saturday afternoon on LaSalle Street years and years ago when I was a little kid, and around 3 o'clock, Mrs. Shannon, the heavy Irish woman in her perpetually soup-stained dress, opened her back window and shouted out into the courtyard, "Hey, say, sir, to you who? I think you're on television. I swear it's you." When I heard the opening strains of the I Love Lucy show, I got excited because I knew she was referring to An Item of Eternity, that episode in which my dead father and my Uncle Cesar had appeared playing Ricky Ricardo's singing cousins fresh off the farm in Oriente Province, Cuba, and north in New York for an engagement at Ricky's nightclub, the Tropicana. This was close enough to the truth about their real lives. There were musicians and songwriters who had left Havana for New York in 1949, the year they formed the Mambo Kings, an orchestra that packed clubs, dance halls, and theaters around the East Coast. In excitement of excitements, they even made a fabled journey in a flamingo pink bus out to Sweet's Ballroom in San Francisco, playing on an all-star Mambo night, a beautiful night of glory, beyond death, beyond pain, beyond all stillness. Yeah. Just a bit.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. You actually did write, you also did write lyrics, I don't know if you actually wrote music, for this song. You wrote the song, Beautiful Maria of My Soul.
Uh-huh, yeah. And there are 22 versions of that floating around. I sort of related to Nestor. I mean, Nestor was me in the sense that he was always sitting around fiddling with a pad, and that's how I feel about writing. I mean, I'm always... I am very admiring of very well-organized writers who sit down and knock out stories all the time, but it takes me forever. I just work with notes and scribbling, and that's sort of what I did with this song. There are right now two versions of Beautiful Maria, My Soul, running around in the world like crazy children, and we're trying to decide which one may be used for the movie. The singer Dave Burns is supposed to do some of the incidental movie music, and they're going to use real authentic mambos from that period, and they want to use Beautiful Maria, although I think that they should get a real pro in to write that song.
Yeah.
But I'm like Nestor in some ways, introspective, quiet. I'm also like Cesar, crazy sometimes. So, you know, it's all elements of a personality.
Well, and they seem to be, you know, I think one point you use the word flip side.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, the two personalities of these two men are sort of the two personalities that are in this music. I mean, it's the great moments when you want to dance, and it's the other moments when you want to cry, which is sort of all part of the...
That's life.
Yeah.
That's what the people say.
we better not start singing here. We'll be in a whole lot of trouble.
When I was 17? No, anyway, go ahead.
Well, actually, when I finished reading the book, I started thinking of another song, but I
which
but
is that?
It actually, I don't know if this is silly, but I started thinking about a song that was written by Peter Townsend.
And oh, really?
It's a song called After the Fire.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that tune?
Refresh my memory.
Well, the thing I was thinking about is the chorus, which goes, I hope I can remember, get this right. After the fire, the fire still burns, the heart grows older but never ever learns, memory smolders, the soul always yearns, after the fire still burns.
Uh-huh.
And that somehow I thought, you know, I must have been feeling some stuff, and that just, and I was just had finished the book, and somehow this song came to me, and I thought, well, I sort of feel like maybe that's kind of what
it's about.
What it's about.
Yeah, I think it's about memory. Mm-hmm. Memory and love, and wanting to keep things alive, as everybody wants to.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, César, who is I don't want to give a lot of the book away because I hope people will read it. Decides
do subliminal.
Decides he's
suggestion. Buy the book. buy the book. Book.
Decides he's done. You know, he's finished because he can't. Well, because he can't live life as he would want to anymore.
You mean by the end of the book?
Yeah.
No, I just think that, you know, youth is a beautiful thing and everyone makes mistakes. And I just think that, I just think it's lost longing for love. I mean, you know, you can only live in the present, but, you know, it's sad that if you're loved or you love, it sort of fades into the past. You know, it all vanishes except in your memory. And I think that's the side of, I think that's what he just wishes he could have, everything back again. I mean, you can't, but that's a good thing about novels. I mean, on page 360, César is an old man, and on page like 50, he's not. Yeah. So it's sort of a strange medium.
Well, it's been good talking with you. I appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed being here, and it's a nice part of the country, and I'm enjoying myself.